Hello, thank you for downloading this podcast of the NYU Abu Dhabi Institute. We hope you enjoy listening to this. For more information about our programs, please visit www.nyuad.nyu.edu/institute.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to 19 Washington Square North, which is the intellectual center and home of NYU Abu Dhabi here in New York. My name is Michael Puruganan. I'm a silver professor of biology here at NYU New York. But I also run a laboratory at NYU Abu Dhabi working on the study of date palms. And also I'm the academic director of 19 Washington Square North. And so it is a pleasure to welcome all of you here today. So over the academic year, 19 Washington Square North is host to many numerous programs, lectures, seminars, conferences, and workshops. And it also serves as a meeting place for students, faculty, and indeed members of the general public to interact and learn about the work of NYU Abu Dhabi and in general about the Emirates and the Gulf region. A key partner for us here at 19 Washington Square North is the NYU Abu Dhabi Institute. And I'd like to acknowledge Sharon Hakaken-Bergman, who is the Director for Academic and Research Programs of the Institute, who organizes many of the talks and activities here at 19 Washington Square North. And here, with her the organization of her series, we're able to learn and hear experts talk about cultural research, the societal relevance of their work, technological and cultural impact, and importance for the world at large. And today we're very, very pleased to see all of you at this lecture on Emirati cuisine and history. I especially want to welcome Her Excellency Amna bin Zal Al Nuhairi, the Consul General of the United Arab Emirates in New York City, who is gracing us with her presence. She not only graces us with her presence, but she has also provided some of the food that we will enjoy after the talk. So thank you very much. And at this point, I would also like to acknowledge Maysam Lateef, the Cultural Advisor of the UAE Consulate in New York, who has been a great partner of us here at 19 as well. Thank you very much, Maysam, for all your help to 19. So today's talk is in celebration of the UAE National Day. While we are a little late, as the National Day was celebrated last Saturday, we nevertheless are happy to have this program to join in the festivities. And to this end, we've invited Professor Jonathan Shannon to give us a talk on Emirati cuisine and the strands of history and culture that flow through it. Professor Shannon is a professor of anthropology at the CUNY Graduate Center, a former Guggenheim Fellow. His area of research is on Middle Eastern culture, specifically Middle Eastern music, and he has published several books on this topic, but he has broad interests in the culture of the region, including the culture surrounding food. From 2018 to 2021, he was a visiting professor of anthropology, head of the Arab Crossroads Studies and Music Programs, and associate dean of arts and humanities at NYU Abu Dhabi. And today, this day serves as the faculty director for the J-term curriculum at the NYU Abu Dhabi Office of Global Education. So thank you very much, Professor Shannon, for joining us here, and the floor is yours.
Thank you, Michael, for that kind introduction, and thank you to everybody coming. Special welcome again to Her Excellency and for Maysam Lateef from the UAE Consulate General. It's a pleasure to be here tonight and to speak with you. I'm very happy to see several familiar faces, friends, colleagues, even former students. So welcome. Again, my interest is in more generally Middle Eastern culture, music, and food. They often go together. And so when you study one, you can't help but study the other. And I often joke with people, the study of food comes naturally to many of us because, you know, I love food. I've been eating it since I was a kid. And like most of us, I think we have a very strong attachment to food and its different manifestations. And of course, and the UAE is certainly no exception. So tonight, what I'd like to do is give an overview of the origins and evolution of Emirati cuisine as an expression of Emirati culture and history. Did that pop through on its own? There we go. The UAE has seen over 125,000 years of human habitation. Despite it being a young nation state founded in 1971, over 125,000 years of habitation in this region. It's an ancient land, but with an exciting present and a wonderful, we hope, inshallah, future. Historically, the foodways grew in tandem with developments in the region in the context of trade across both the Indian Ocean and the Arabian Peninsula. Today, the rise of an Emirati cuisine parallels the remarkable transformation of this ancient land into a global leader in technology, in culture, as well as in the transition to a more sustainable and secure future, not only for the Emirates, but for the whole world, as I will be arguing tonight. The UAE certainly has a varied topography, but historically it's been primarily the desert and the sea which have formed the primary poles, not only for its economy and society, but of course for its food base, its culinary traditions. So therefore my talk is entitled Sand, Seas, and Stars. Now you might be wondering about the stars bit. Despite what Elon Musk might be leading us to believe, we're not yet living in the stars, but we live amongst the stars. And as we'll see, the stars become a very important destination, not just for foodways, but for Emirati culture. Each of these zones represents historical, cultural, and ecological connections that form the basis for Emirati foodways. And it's important for us to think of a distinction between food, and this keeps doing this on its own. I think it must be on a timer. Or cuisine on one hand and foodways on the other. Not all the foods consumed in the UAE today, or even historically, are Emirati of origin. And yet, Emirati foodways are tantalizingly rich today, enriched by the food and foodways of many neighboring cultures and societies. So I want to keep that distinction in mind, foodways versus just food. So again, the origin of Emirati culture and society can be found in with the Bedouin. Bedouin society and culture is the foundation for not only the UAE, but of course, many of the other communities nearby in the GCC nations. With this relatively harsh environment, the desert imposed the necessity for frugality, but also careful management of natural resources. This is certainly in keeping today with the vision of the UAE's founder, Sheikh Zayed, who said, and I'll quote from him, "We cherish our environment because it is an integral part of our country, our history, and our heritage. On land and in the sea, our forefathers lived and survived in this environment. They were able to do so only because they recognized the need to conserve it, to take from it only what they needed to live, and to preserve it for successive generations. With God's will, we shall continue to work to protect our environment and our wildlife, as did our forefathers before us. It is a duty. And if we fail, our children rightly will reproach us for squandering an essential part of their inheritance and of our heritage." Now, Sheikh Zayed said this regarding the Emirates, but I think this is a message that all of us should embrace today. It's also worth saying, I'm sorry about the timer going off there. The desert is not empty, despite our notions of the empty quarter and the desert just being sand, when in fact it hosts myriad flora and fauna that the Bedouin have exploited for centuries in a sort of eco-dynamism that has been very rich and provided the Bedouin culture with a great variety of foodstuffs. The diet itself focused on grains, pulses, and other staples, along with dates. Meat, milk, and cheese came from herd animals, goats, sheep, and less often camel, since the food had to travel with them, given their nomadic lifestyle. So they had to have mobile food to go with their mobile lifestyle. The oases provided very important opportunities for trade, but also provisioning and for cultural exchange. Again, the desert is not empty. It's full of oases, it's full of plants and animals, and supported life for many centuries. This is actually a picture I took from Al Wathwa cycling track, but you can see camels and various herbs, shrubs growing around the region. And those of you who've been to the UAE will know that the desert certainly is not empty at all. While the desert plays a very important role in the foundations of Emirati culture and also in its cultural imaginary, it's also important for us to remind ourselves of the seas, because they play a very important role as well. Of course, the seas provide food, fish, for example, and other seafood, but more importantly, perhaps they also provide opportunities for economic development, for trade, for pearling, shipbuilding, and so forth. In fact, trade and cultural exchange in the broader Indian Ocean region, the sort of cultural sphere, brought to the Gulf and the Arabian Peninsula a wealth of spices, foodstuffs, and recipes, as well as musical and other cultural forms that still resonate today, not only on the tables of Emirati families and in restaurants, of course, but also in concert halls and in everyday life, language patterns and so forth. So these multiple influences can be tasted in the UAE's rich foodways today. There are some examples of some fish here. I'm featuring my son who caught this wonderful emperor fish 3 years ago on his birthday, because today is his 21st birthday. And he allowed me to show it. He was a little bit embarrassed, but he said, that's fine. There's a fish biryani and some fish from the Abu Dhabi fish market, photos that I took. Most of the photos you'll see are ones that I took when I was there. Now, some of the typical dishes that arise from this ecosystem of desert and sea, in addition to some of the plateaus and even mountain regions, include some of these that I've mentioned here. Dates are perhaps primary. There are literally hundreds of varieties of dates available for purchase and many thousands that exist. Most of us know the Majhul or Majhul date, which literally means of unknown origin, although we actually know that it comes from Tafilalt in southeastern Morocco. Or we know the Dijlet Noor dates, these little smaller dates, often from Tunisia. But in fact, the Emirates, just off the top of your head, one could say Ajwa, Barhi, Khalas, Khudri, Halawi, Safawi, Sukri, Wanan, et cetera, et cetera. There are literally scores and scores of varieties of dates that you can buy on any given day in the marketplace, let alone many hundreds of other varieties that are not commercialized yet. And they have dates that are very low in sugar, that'd be appropriate for diabetic diets. Dates that have all sorts of mineral contents are very healthy and can be a foundation, as they have been for centuries, for a healthful diet. Qaymat, I wouldn't say that they're necessarily a foundation for a healthful diet, but they're very delicious, small deep fried balls of dough, literally like mouth bite sized, dipped in date syrup. They're commonly found in receptions all across the UAE and quite delicious. Bathitha, chopped dates with wheat and nuts, with mixed with spices, something I made with my students. It's quite easy to make, although the dates break your blender if you're not careful, you don't have a really good one. It's quite delicious, simple to make these little date balls. Chabab or chabab, an Emirati pancake served with honey and some clotted cream, for example. But often with these wonderful spices that are part and parcel of so many dishes in the UAE, like rose water and cardamom and so forth. There are many other types of breads, including ragag or rakak and khamir bread, and many varieties of them. Some examples that you see below of some dates and qaymat and shbab on the other end, khamir and bathitha in the third one from the left. Again, quite delicious, very simple, but also healthful, usually. Other typical dishes include these meat-based dishes. Common elements in many of the traditional dishes will be slow-cooked meats with rice or wheat, like haris, for example, balalit, machbous, which is similar to kebsa, or makbous, a sort of national dish in many of the Gulf countries, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, Qatar, the UAE, amongst others. It's similar to biryani. And I don't want to get into the biryani battles. I was actually a participant in a debate about the origins of biryani, and it was online. It was called the Biryani Battles. It was quite heated. But I should note that rice cultivation in the Middle East dates back over 2,000 years. So it's not simply an import that South Asian migrants brought to them in the 70s or 80s, but something that's been circulating in the region for many thousands of years. Asiatic rice is a latecomer to the Mediterranean, but relatively widespread in antiquity. Has its origins, of course, in China many thousands of years ago. So what many people might think that, well, this is just a recent addition, actually rice has been part of the diet for some time. If you don't believe me, you can go to Frying Pan Adventures in Dubai with Arwa Ahmed and engage in some biryani battles with her, but also taste some wonderful food that you find in the Dubai market. So here's some examples of photos that you can see of haris, balalit, machbous, and tarid. Again, slow-cooked foods, meats with either wheat or rice, but also always accentuated with these wonderful variety of spices. And it should be noted that you can go to the marketplace and buy a collection of spices, but the best spices are pounded and made at home, are collected by Emirati cooks, grandmothers, and now young people themselves learning to collect the spices from the market, grind them themselves, and flavor their foods with them. Same way which is done in, for example, in Morocco. You can buy Ras El Hanout, which is literally means the top shelf of the local store, a pre-made spice blend, but most good Moroccan chefs will make their own spice blends at home, often with their secret recipes that they sparingly divulge. Sagu, asida, khabisa, are also sort of sweet dishes that you might find at the end of a meal or just as a sort of a snack. But the real star, I think, of a lot of these occasions for eating in the Emirates and occasions for socializing, which is really why people eat, of course, to nourish their bodies, but they also eat to nourish their families and their communities. Food is quintessentially a moral substance. It brings us together as commensals around a table. And one of the major food items to do that is coffee or gahwa. Coffee culture in the UAE is around the Gulf is distinct from what we know of as, for example, Turkish coffee or Arab coffee slash Greek coffee, which are all kind of the same sort of Ottoman coffee, sort of little pot with the dregs at the bottom and maybe some cardamom put in. Although there are shared understandings of hospitality through coffee, Emirati coffee is distinct the way it's created, the way it's boiled, and with the spices that it uses, including saffron, cardamom, rose water, and so forth. The rituals in by which it is presented are also distinct. And if you've not had an experience with Emirati coffee culture, I encourage you to try it because it's really quite elaborate and quite tasty. Very different from what you would expect from an Italian espresso or a Turkish coffee. In fact, after, I was a little skeptical, to be honest, having spent many years in Syria and years in Turkey, which have wonderful culinary traditions, I thought, well, how could this coffee be any good? Then I tasted it. It's like, oh my gosh, this is really special. It's very different. And I'm a coffee lover and big fan. But so if you can get some gahwa in you, go for it. So here's a few pictures here of these traditional dishes. And of course, the traditional coffee pot there as it's being poured out. One feature of Emirati hospitality is the fawala, which is a sort of plate of fresh fruit, halwa, kebab or khamir breads, and other foods. That's not exactly it, but that's the only picture I could find that was similar to it. But it's part of it's the hospitality culture. So when you go to somebody's home, it just automatically will come out. They often have special ones for Eid, for Ramadan, for weddings. Because hospitality is key. Again, Emiratis, like everybody else, eat to nourish their bodies, but they nourish their families. This is an occasion for telling stories, recounting adventures, creating new friends. You have to be aware, however, that when you do go to the UAE or to any Arab country, that food is so important that you will be not only asked to eat, invited to eat, you'll be asked to eat or even forced to eat. In fact, some of my colleagues in Middle East studies talk about what we refer to jokingly as guesticide, that when you go to somebody's home, they'll feed you until you literally explode from all the food. So if you do go, please, I recommend that you fast for a couple of days and really open up your appetite, because that hospitality is central to it. And you find it elsewhere, from Rabat to Ras Al Khaimah, from Istanbul to Khartoum, wherever you go in the region, there's that essential hospitality. It's quite beautiful, but a little bit dangerous. Okay, from an anthropological standpoint, I'm an anthropologist, I can't help it. If we move away from the term Emirati food and these traditional dishes, which are delicious if you eat them and enjoy them, and there are restaurants you can go to in the UAE, like Fanar and so forth, that specialize in these dishes. But if we move away from this notion of Emirati food to foodways of the UAE, then we encounter an even wider and deeper array of dishes, including foods from the Levant and North Africa, but more clearly foods from the various South Asian and Southeast Asian diasporas, European and global foods, including, alas, fast food, and innovative dishes that blend elements of all of these together. Emirati foodways, like all foodways, are emergent. That means at once they're based in traditions and lifeways and recipes that have been inherited from over the generations, but also adapting the palate to regional and even global influences. So for example, we see on this image, I'm getting hungry just looking at it, my favorite restaurant on the lower left, I hate to admit, Manouchi Street in Abu Dhabi for Manaish. And having lived in Damascus, and the best place for Manaish, those little flatbreads, is in the old city of Damascus. I'm sorry, I'm not gonna get into Manaish battles with Lebanese or other Palestinians, but this was almost as good. And it was kind of addictive to order Manaish from Manouchi Street. But of course, they didn't just have Manaish, the traditional ones. They had all sorts of innovative ones, hybrid ones, fusion ones, including some I'll talk about in a moment. Second image is from Opal, which is in the fruit and vegetable market. It's a South Indian or Malayali restaurant, where I took a friend who actually works in Kerala. He said, The food he ate there is as good as the food he would eat in Trivandrum in Kerala. Beautiful. Street food outside of the Mohammed bin Rashid Tower in Abu Dhabi. Again, street food festivals. And of course, Shake Shack, which is everywhere. Sometimes it's the only thing that's open in the middle of the night. And you have to pass all the Nissan patrols to get yourself in there because it's very popular and crowded. But also, you know, my son certainly liked it. So that's hence I have the picture of it. So great. All sorts of diversity there. Beyond the Haris and the Machbous and so forth, there's a whole world, in fact, the world of culinary treats right at your doorstep. So this raises this question, what is a national food then? If you've got all these things like Shake Shack and biryani, what is a national food? Well, food studies, we talk about the pizza effect and we think, well, pizza, Italian cuisine. Well, we know that pizza itself, what we know of pizza today actually arose not in Naples, Calabria, Sicilia. It grew up in Philadelphia, New York City, and was re-imported of simple flatbread from Naples, from that region, from Campania, for example, was brought with immigrants to the United States. Then in these Italian-American enclaves in Philadelphia, in particular in New York, and also New Haven, it turns out, developed what we call today pizza, like a pizza pie. And it was returned migrants, including Italian-American soldiers during the war, who came back and brought recipes with them or even demanded that the Italians make this. Kind of like the carbonara, for example. Oh, it's a quintessentially Italian dish. Actually not. It's a quintessentially American soldier influenced dish from the 40s, like the Americano coffee and so forth. So when we think about a national food, it's okay to embrace this diversity and this fusion and this innovation, hybridity, because all national cuisines are based in these culinary imaginations that are full of all sorts of selections and amnesias of things that had been locally relevant, but also foodstuffs that are imported from outside. One of the most important of these, of course, is chips Oman. If you've not had chips Oman, you're probably wondering, chips Oman? Like, that's Oman, first of all. It's not UAE. It's not called chips Emirati or something, or chips or crisps. Well, there's the bag of chips Oman over here. But what happens when you take chips Oman, you add some sort of cheese and a paratha from South Asia, you have heaven at the end of it. It's epic. The chips Oman sandwich. Going back here, Manushi Street, you can actually get the manaish, the sort of flatbreads with za'atar and these sorts of things. You can also get a chips Oman anushi. And that was, I have to say, rather compelling. I'll put it that way. I won't say addictive. Karak chai, literally in Hindi, it means strong tea. You know, milk, sugar, condensed milk, sugar, black tea leaves, various spices, such as cinnamon, cardamom, ginger, and so forth, is a sort of a national drink. So that people don't even think, oh, karak, I'm going to get some Indian chai. It's like, no, we're going to get karak, which is an Emirati drink par excellence. You find it everywhere. Students will, be drinking it on campus. Film students doing capstone projects on karak. It's amazing. It's beautiful. It's lovely. And you can see here, menu for the various varieties of karak that are great, including this wonderful picture of this guy pouring it in a shop down in Hamdan Street. And there's the original bag. Chips Oman. I actually talked to an Omani. He said, chips Oman sandwiches, they're Omani. I said, well, do you actually make them there? It's like, well, I don't know, but I had one in Abu Dhabi and it's called Oman, so it must be Omani. I said, no, names can be confusing. So again, what is a national dish in the UAE? You could say machbous, you can say that, that's fine. It is a national dish of the nation, but ones that are consumed perhaps more frequently would include like manaish, chips Oman, and a wide variety of other types of foods. And that's what makes it so these foods 100% Emirati without being 100% Emirati, like any other cuisine. So the UAE's this wonderful, there are lots of examples of this as Emiratis embrace various food cultures from around the world. UAE is a locus of culinary innovation as well, often led by the DCT or the Department of Culture and Tourism's Emirati Cuisine Program. And this is an ambitious country, young country that's trying to create all these avenues, almost like an incubator for new ideas in technology and culture, music, but also in cuisine. So you have, for example, you'll laugh because it's a funny word, but machbous soto. It's a mix of machbous and risotto at Salama's restaurant in my old neighborhood in Memsha in Abu Dhabi. Or you can go and get some chips Oman maki rolls, like sushi, chips Oman sushi. Sounds a little bit maybe disgusting, but I'll leave that to you. But it's quite popular if you go to Moshi's in the Barsha of Dubai. Dubai has a wonderful food scene as well. I know Abu Dhabi's best. Camel milk chocolate truffles. There's a lot of things that are made with camel milk now. You can get them at Osmo, for example, in Abu Dhabi. Again, the DCT is promoting these sorts of experiments with culinary innovation and fusion. There are many other examples as Emirati chefs actually train in fancy culinary academies and come back and apply their skills to developing something that's not just traditional, not just a mix of random things, but something uniquely Emirati and innovative, something that's de novo innovative cuisine, which you can't necessarily identify with. There's a little bit of Italian risotto and some ranch goose, and you kind of put it together and it's fun. That happens. That's also fun and tasty, but something that's literally creative from start. I'm not sure. There's the machi rolls. I'm not sure if you might want to try it. The machi risotto was good. Let's move to this last ecosystem, the stars, our third and final frontier. So in 2020, the UAE successfully launched its Mars mission, the HOPE probe, becoming the first Arab country and only the fifth country ever to reach Mars. Quite an accomplishment. This is a sign of the audacity of this small nation of only 10 million people to achieve such aspirations and literally put their mark in space. As it plants itself firmly among the stars that are, of course, visible from the expanse of the desert, the UAE also looks toward longer horizons here on Earth as it prepares for uncertain futures related to the challenges of climate change and food security. In order to address these twin challenges, which are related, the UAE has developed programs ensuring sustainable development, agricultural technology or ag tech, and green and smart city initiatives that I'd just like to review very briefly. The UAE, of course, already enjoys a very high degree of food security. It's number 23 in the so-called GFSI, or Global Food Security Index. This is because they've learned some lessons from their founder, Sheikh Zayed, in that Bedouin past. Better management of scarce and diminishing natural resources can lead to sustainable development. However, approximately 85% of the UAE's foods are imported, and only 0.7% of the land is arable or suitable for agriculture. That means 99.3% of the land is not suitable for agriculture. Only 2 to 3% of the water sources are fresh and potable. The rest comes from desalination plants, which there's a large, enormous one in Dubai. You see the picture there. By the way, in terms of the top of the GFSI, Finland and Ireland are number 1 and 2, respectively. Canada is number 7, and the USA is number 13. The UAE has the goal of becoming number 1 in the world, and I'll talk about some of those initiatives in just a moment. And given its track record, launching probes around Mars and even more recent expeditions are about to start, I don't doubt that they can achieve it. So reliance on food imports, will be an important part of the UAE's food security strategies for many decades because of the lack of arable land. The COVID-19 pandemic revealed many fissures in the global food supply chain. So in 2017, before the pandemic, in a very prescient move, the UAE appointed the world's first ever Minister of State for Food Security, Her Excellency Maryam Al-Maheri. She is now currently UAE Minister of Climate Change and Environment. Having somebody at that, somebody who's enormously qualified and skilled at that level of ministerial responsibility shows the commitment of this country to confronting and solving the challenges of food security and climate change. It's also part of a larger strategy to diversify the UAE's economy. I like this picture I found online. It's an Emirati flag behind the tractor. However, our global food production system today, including agriculture and transport, accounts for more than a third of anthropogenic greenhouse gases, those created by human use. Over a third between agriculture and transportation combined. Some countries it's higher, in the UAE it will be higher. And this is important, not just because, well, climate change is bad and global warming is altering ecosystems around the world, but it threatens food security, not only for the UAE, but globally, since it undermines the ability of nations with limited natural resources of land and water to produce adequate food, particularly for a growing population. In addition, climate change exacerbates problems in the global supply chains. Early on in the pandemic, when I was living in Abu Dhabi, I think it was maybe March or April of 2020, the price of onions skyrocketed. For most of us, we don't survive on onions, so it wasn't a huge deal, and it went back down after a while. But you can see how this disruptions in supply chains could have a series of consequences that could be very deleterious for people who rely not just on onions, obviously, but on more essential food staples such as wheat, for example, and rice. So as the UAE confronts these twin challenges of climate change and food security, it has embraced technological and policy solutions to what are urgent global problems. So the UAE is hosting COP28, the Conference of Parties to the UN Framework Conference on Climate Change. UAE is number 7 globally as a petrostate, with an output of about 4 million barrels per day, which they plan to increase in the coming days. So the UAE is actually a major contributor to climate change. And some have perhaps rightfully questioned whether the UAE should be hosting COP28 and that the CEO, Dr. Sultan Jaber, as the chairperson of the COP28 conference. There's been a lot of back and forth in the news media recently. Some have said that this is hypocritical given their role as a major fossil fuel producer as well as exporter. Some have said it's kind of like having the fox manage the renovations of the hen house. I like the Finnish motto better. It's using the goat as the guardian of the cabbage patch. However, it's also important to note a couple of things. One, the USA, Saudi Arabia, and Russia are the top 3 producers of petroleum products, fossil fuels, and produce 10 times the emissions of the UAE. And yet nobody is complaining as loudly about the US's inaction. In fact, as we've ramped up under the current administration, ramped up fossil fuel production. Secondly, we've already seen some positive change coming out of COP28, including agreements to finance a fund to help the developing nations more quickly develop and embrace alternative energy sources, clean or cleaner energy sources. And the argument can be made that bringing industry to the table is likely the only way to really move past the usual platitudes about having to do something. This is COP28. This is not COP1 or 2. We've been doing this for a while, a lot of talk. So it probably makes some sense to have industry at the table because we already see some of these results happening. Nonetheless, COP28 and climate change are very relevant for our understanding of food security for reasons I've already explained. If the UAE can't solve its problems, increasingly other nations as well who are heading that direction will not be able to solve their problems. So what the UAE is able to do can offer us a model for action in other contexts. In fact, the UAE is at the forefront of developing alternative and cleaner energy sources to reduce the reliance on fossil fuels and to reduce the other side of the coin of production is consumption. So it's up to us as well to reduce our consumption of fossil fuels and embrace some of these alternative sources. So in order to combat anthropogenic climate change and greenhouse gas emissions, UAE is at the forefront. And we have a picture here of the Noor Abu Dhabi solar facility, the largest in the world, 1.2 gigawatt facility with 3.2 million solar panels. It's just one of about half a dozen that are in and around Dubai and Abu Dhabi. So the transition to cleaner energy can have a positive impact on the food system by reducing greenhouse gas emissions and creating a framework for more sustainable agriculture at home and with the UAE's partner countries where a lot of their foods are sourced. So again, they're investing billions of dollars with the goal of being carbon neutral by 2050. Now, carbon neutral could be a sort of phantasmic target, and there are lots of ways of reaching carbon neutral or even defining it that kind of water it down, but at least we see they're moving in the right direction, which is quite encouraging. The UAE is leveraging new technologies to address food security. These include such ag tech strategies as vertical farming, precision irrigation to reduce waste, new seed technologies. By the way, this does not include GMO, which is outlawed in the UAE, but hybrid seeds that are drought resistant, or halophytic plants, those that can grow in more saline environments. Aquaculture, we can see an example from the Emirates fish farm. I took my students there. It's quite fun. We're out in the middle of nowhere in the desert. It's like, boom, this big facility raising fish from egg to final fish. Cloud seeding, of course, some of you have been in the UAE, you know about cloud seeding, and public-private partnerships such as ADQ, Silal. ADQ is the Abu Dhabi Developmental Holding Company, run by Dr. Mohammed Hassan Suwaidi, Minister of Investment and the CEO of ADQ. So Silal is one of these companies that's doing that. UAE is home to experimental farms, including the Emirates Biofarm, run by our friend Yazan Qudmani. There's a picture of that on the top. You wouldn't expect to see that in the UAE, but they grow not just lettuce and herbs and cherry tomatoes, which is what you can do in vertical farming, but actual produce. They raise chickens and fish. They've got squash. I was a member of their CSA, or Community Supported Agriculture, and I get a box a week from Emirates Biofarm. It's always huge. I can never eat all of it. Well, included the lettuces and stuff, but lots of like tomatoes and zucchini and all sorts of stuff. It was a model for growing a sustainable agricultural system, agroecology, in a desert environment using rich soils that you see here, which are actually sandy. But the sand, the pink sand that you see, again, sand is not all the same. There's not just one type of sand. The sort of rich mineralized sand can actually, with some adaptations, be suitable for agriculture, expanding that 0.7% of arable land to be a little bit greater. Madar Farms is another one. That's the lower left picture of Madar Farms, focusing a lot on vertical agriculture and a greenhouse. In addition to clean energy initiatives and some of the ag tech, you know, plates making and urban design strategies are promoting smarter cities. These include strategies that optimize energy sources, develop smarter transportation systems, decrease carbon and water footprint, because water footprint is very important, of agriculture as well as of everyday life, so that the UAE is becoming a global leader in sustainability and clean energy. When applied to the food system, this means greater sustainable agricultural development at home and responsive and responsible regional and global food supply chains, because UAE holds vast agricultural holdings in South Asia and Africa, and how they interact with their partners, including the development of agricultural plans there and what we call virtual water, has an impact on the global situation. So a responsibility at home and respect responsibility with their partner countries creates a food system which is more sustainable overall. So these initiatives arise not only because the UAE is this home for a burgeoning knowledge economy and then technical sophistication and ambition, but because of an urgent need and an urgent necessity to develop sustainable pathways toward the future. As the population grows, it's not sustainable just to keep doing the same thing over and over again. For this reason, I often tell people that the UAE is our collective future. The extreme heats they experience now as part of everyday life are what we will be experiencing in our future, in our near-term future, if not already. You know, going out and finding it 52 degrees Celsius, you know, even my dog at times, who is a desert dog, a Saluki, he'd be like, man, it's kind of too hot for me. But you adapt to it. Well, how do you deal with that in New York City or in Houston or in San Francisco? Well, we have a model already in Abu Dhabi and Dubai and elsewhere for how to do that. So the challenges they currently face: rising sea levels, extreme weather, diminishing water resources, poor air quality, loss of already scarce arable land, and threats to biodiversity. It's what we are all facing now everywhere, either now or in the not too distant future. So the UAE is our future in many ways. So to conclude this, you know, admittedly brief overview, Emirati Foodways have played an important role in defining and developing the UAE's national culture. Foodways, of course, not only reflect what people eat, but they also reflect and promote how people think, how they feel, and toward what they might aspire. Therefore, I would say that foodways are landscapes of hope, especially in the hands of a nation that is struggling to achieve sustainable development that is also cognizant of the challenges of climate change. So Emirati traditions and foodways offer us a vision for our future that is of an ambitious young nation, home to ancient traditions and global aspirations, from which we have much to learn. With that, I say shukran, thank you very much.
You've been listening to a download from the NYU Abu Dhabi Institute. You'll find more information on our website, www.nyuad.nyu.edu/institute.